Welcome. I am Emmy Louie, and you are listening to the Emmy Louie Show. We are here with Carol Heider, and our topic today is interview with Carol Heider. Carol Heider is a feng shui consultant, and she studied with Lin Yun, a master feng shui teacher of the Black Sect tradition, as well as Roger Green, a master in the traditional compass school perspective. Carol has presented numerous keynote speeches across the country on feng shui. She is author of two books and producer of a DVD video. Carol also presents a monthly feng shui segment on KARE 11 Showcase Minnesota, a morning TV news program. Carol is founder, president, and instructor of the Wind and Water School of Feng Shui, licensed by the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. Carol is also founder and president of the Feng Shui Institute of the Midwest. Welcome, Carol Heider.
Thank you, Emmy. It's good to be here.
Thank you for being on the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm doing really well. Thank you. I've just returned from a trip to China, so sort of still basking in that, in the marvels of all of that.
So. Well, great. You need to tell us about it because I want to hear something good today.
Well, the tour this year, every year, my husband and I take a group to China with a focus on feng shui. And this year, the narrower focus was gardens, feng shui gardens. And so we spent a lot of time in southern China, where it was very hot, and humid. But we walked through some really incredible gardens that have been around through Ming and Qing dynasties, which is pretty old, and they're very traditional gardens, and very interesting to see the makeup and the sort of underlying principles of feng shui that were put into place, not always blatantly obvious, but the subtlety, the symbolism behind it make it very intentional, very interesting to see.
Well, why would I be interested in coming with you on this tour? Because I know it's totally different when you travel versus looking at these pictures in a book. What is it that you gain from actually going to it versus seeing it in a picture?
Even if we sold you on the idea of going to China to study feng shui, once you just get there, it almost doesn't matter what you do because you're there and you walk the land and you see the people and you're immersed in the culture. And so a very palpable influence is happening just as you're there on their soil. But aside from that, along the way, we really focus in on creating experiences for people that will not only give them an introduction to the Chinese culture, but also support any feng shui experience they may have. I have people on there who've been students of mine for years, and I have people on there who don't know a lot about feng shui. And so we try to bridge the gap for everybody so that if we're going to a certain space, I typically will spend some time every morning sort of prepping people about, here's what we're going to see, here's some interesting feng shui facts about it that you could watch for and look for, see how you feel about it, see where your body takes in the experience when you get there. And so it becomes real personal. We also do an I Ching reading every morning with the group, so we kind of set a pace, set a tone for every day. And so it becomes real personal. A lot of people journal along the way, even though we're pretty busy and don't have a lot of just totally downtime. Still, we do try to allow some time for people to kind of step back and reflect and take a look at, you know, what they're doing, what they're experiencing, what they're seeing.
I didn't know that you could do a group I Ching reading. Tell me about that.
Yeah, you sure can. Well, what we do is we focus on what the intention is for the day, and it really develops some enormous group energy so that, yes, you can have your own personal intention that says that, you know, I want to know what I'm doing around this particular issue, around making a decision around a particular problem. But When we do our travels together, what we our intention is typically what is the energy for the day? What are some things that we what kind of energy do we want to carry with us? And sometimes and so I'll be the designated holder of the coins, and then you know I lay them out, and then we read them. And a lot of people bring their own I Ching books. They don't have to. We record them every day so that when you go home you can look them up and see what you think. And sometimes the coins will say something like be cautious today, or you know, hold back from too much exuberance. And you know, we'll typically find, well, you know, that was really true. You know, we went to a shopping mall we went to a little street market, and just remembering to just hold back and not let yourself go wild buying stuff. Or it might say, this is a day for rejoicing, or this is a day for family. And so by all of us having that same kind of reading, it sets up a very tangible bond between all of us. The groups that go, you know, by the end of it, you've created, if you don't already know them, you know everybody, there's a bond, there's sort of a karmic tie that from years on, when you see that person or when you run across, there's that recognition that we travel together and we ate together and we shared experiences together like no one else has done. So it's it really supports that. That's what the I Ching reading does. It supports that group dynamic.
So is the group across from all over the world or the country, or is it from your area?
They tend to be just from my area. I market pretty much around here, although certainly people can come from anywhere. And a lot of my students aren't from around here either, and so they tend to fly in from different places. I may have clients that I've worked with who lived here, and now they've moved away, and they want to go on this trip. So, yeah, majority are probably from the Midwest area, but we certainly don't limit it to that at all. We like people who understand feng shui, who are open to the idea of it. They don't have to be versed in it in any way at all, but certainly need to have an awareness of it. And because along the way you learn about it, whether you want to or not, because we're always talking about it, and I'm always pointing out aspects of it.
I think it's interesting that when you talk about tours, I was just thinking about the tours that I've been to, because you can go to a very generic tour from across the country. In other words, it's a tour of a representation of different people across the country, and you might not ever see them again, and then you can go on a tour that is a very specific subject, and because of the circle of influence, you might bump into those people, and then if it's a local tour, then you're definitely going to bump into them. I think it's interesting because it sounds like, from even my own experience, that who you go on the tour with really changes your experience.
Yes, it does. Yeah, it does. It becomes real interactive, and
everyone is extremely involved, whether they like it or not. And when someone leaves, let's say if they have to leave early because whatever, they couldn't stay long enough, whatever, it makes a difference.
Yeah, it changes the whole group dynamic. Yeah, exactly. And sometimes we have people who say, I don't want to go to Beijing, I've been to Beijing, so I'll join the group later. And then, you know, the whole dynamic changes. I mean, now we get, you know, we have another person, and it's not that you can't make that happen, but you really watch how the group has to do a different dance. It's very interesting and very dynamic, the ever-changing Tao, as they say. That's exactly what you watch with the group. And
I think it's interesting because when you go on a tour, even though maybe some of the people you don't have never met before, somehow you know them.
Yeah.
It's almost like you know them forever, and when you see them later on, a few months or even a year later, somehow you just had a slice of their life because you spent so much time with them for whatever, 10, 15 days or less or whatever. And it just is rather amazing.
Well, it is, and you know, it can get pretty intimate because you see what triggers people, what they love, where they're moved to tears, what repulses them. You know, you get to a level that's can be pretty poignant, And you don't reach that with a lot of people just on day-to-day interactions.
You don't. Mm-hmm. I think it's very interesting that you said that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You don't,
yeah.
And it's very different in that scenario versus going to a retreat.
Yes.
And I can think of a retreat that I've been to where, and it was funny because we would say we would go to a retreat for a weekend, and then we would come back and said, oh, everybody just said sorry to each other. Now everybody's back to normal, or back to their regular grumpy self again.
Yeah.
In other words, the transformation wasn't as deep for whatever reason as opposed to going on a tour.
All right. I think a retreat, you do that. You retreat. On a tour, you advance. It's the opposite of retreat. You're advancing. And so I think that requires cooperation. Because there's going to be times on tours, and certainly we've seen it, where somebody just doesn't want to do something. And so, you know, for the good of the group, you have a choice. You can go along and be, you know, have a bad attitude. You can go along and get over it. Or you can say, you know, today I'm going to stay behind. And really, the latter two options are really the ones we encourage people, you know. Don't go with us if you don't want to. And almost all of the days, unless we're actually leaving the area, almost all of the days there are options for people to say, I'm tired, I don't really want to do this, I'm tired of Chinese food, I'm going to take a day off. And you know what? We really support that. And we adjust accordingly, and then at night we meet up with them, and they tell us what they did, and we tell them what we did, and it all just goes back to the way it was, and everybody's happy. And that, because it's, you know, it's an expensive trip, and you don't want people to do things they don't want to do, and you also don't want them to influence the rest of the group in a negative way. So
I think what it is, after a certain amount of days, your pattern of your regular pattern, whatever pattern that is,
mm-hmm.
it gets broken.
It does. Yeah, and people handle that in different ways.
Can you tell me some examples without naming names or in general? I mean, you probably...
Well, yeah, I can just do some generic things. You know, I think that we've had people, not on this trip actually, but we've had people who are not morning people. And so we start, you know, we get up at 6:30, we have breakfast arranged for 7:30, and then by 8:30 we're on the bus.
Oh, my God, that's way early.
Yeah, see, that is early. But the truth is, you know, you're there in China, why sleep till 10, and then it's noon before you get on the road. You know, that doesn't make any sense. So the mantra is always 6:30, 7:30, 8:30. You get wake-up call at 6:30, you eat breakfast at 7:30, you're on the bus. There have been people who have said, this is, like, against every way I live my life. This is just not compute. And so, we learn that you don't engage them in a lot of interaction. You don't confront them with a lot of changes that are going to go on right away. You sort of realize that they're not morning people. So, but by noon or by even 11, that everything's fine. But they show up, and a lot of times they just don't even eat because their system's not used to eating that early. And so, you know, luckily we've had people who have been mature enough to say, I don't want to do this, but I'm here on this trip, and I'm going to do it. And the food thing sometimes becomes an issue, too. I mean,
it's a huge issue.
Yeah, people go,
It's probably one of the biggest issues I have known. I mean, I remember even in Egypt, people were complaining about, it's just, there's something about the behavior of having food. I think, I don't know, maybe we could talk this out, but a lot of times in a regular day, we just eat regular, boring food.
Mm-hmm.
Like we might have an apple, we might have eggs.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really have all this intensity of food.
Right, right.
And I think when a tour could be judged by the food that it serves, whereas if the food is, there's many options for food preferences, then it's probably a better tour. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. The way that the tour works when you go to China is...
I know. There's a whole bunch of coordination issues. There's no doubt about it.
But they bring you... when we almost always have vegetarians on our group, and then we always have meat eaters, and they both stand really strong in their convictions. And so in the Chinese tradition, there's this big sort of lazy Susan about 3 feet in diameter that circles, and they start just bringing food. And you get dish after dish. You might have 20 different dishes sitting there. And so some will be vegetarian. Some will be meat, will have meat in them. And then you just, it's family style. And you just help yourself to whatever you, as much or as little as you want. And so rice isn't always served right away. That's a real issue. There's no desserts. You get watermelon at the end of the, I mean, you know when the meal's over because the watermelon shows up. Food comes in different time sequences. So you sit down and you may right away have sweet and sour chicken and some green beans, or, you know, some fixed in some way. And then you eat that, and then all of a sudden here comes 5 more dishes, and then the soup. And the soup is never served in the beginning. There'll be soup along the way. There'll be more vegetables, bok choy. There'll be some kind of pork dish. And then you start eating that. Oh, and then here comes more things. And then sort of towards the end, here comes the rice. And so, you know, every restaurant has a different way, believe it or not, of fixing things. Every restaurant has something different. But even at that, even those slight nuances start to fail when you're just tired of Chinese food. So usually about 3/4 of the way through, we start giving meals off, because people are feeling confident enough about getting around, and they're kind of know the lay of the land and what word
you
to use. You
said what, meal boxes?
Sorry? No, they know right in advance that there's going to be a few nights when they're on their own, and they can go to a Pizza Hut, they can go to a McDonald's, which unfortunately all those are all over, they can go to a KFC, they can go find an Indian restaurant, they can go find, you know, something else.
I think it's interesting because what it is that the group eating that I think that you just described with the lazy Susan in the middle gets old after a while.
It can, although it's a lot of good process time. Sometimes it's an opportunity. It's where good conversation can happen. Oddly enough, even at the very end of the trip, you might find that you're lingering there after all the food is gone. Everybody's engrossed in the conversation. You know, if the group is big enough, you have 2 big tables, and one group may be done right away, and the other group is talking about some event or some, you know, somebody's going on about some life story issue. And so it could definitely get old, and there are times when you just want to get out of there. But quite honestly, that's where those times come where you can get through some obstacles and you can break down some barriers.
What I think is interesting is that I was just thinking about some of the, when I was in groups and they said, well, we're going to have fun. and it's sanctioned fun. We have to have fun. This is what you'd have to do to have fun. And I think it's very interesting because I congratulate you for even pulling this off, because here you are in another country with a different language and everything, and then you got to get a group of people together. And I'm sure with feng shui people and related people, I'm sure everyone has their different preferences. And actually, even Americans, because of the high standard of living that Americans are used to, or Westerners are used to, that's a tall order.
Yes.
That is a tall order.
Yeah, it can be. One of the things we do on our trips is we stay in 4- and 5-star hotels. And part of the reason is really to give them a chance to go back at night and relax. And, you know, the beds are fabulous. You can use regular, normal bathrooms. You have a hot shower. During the day, we may be off in the road. We may be in a little tea plantation where it's a little bit more rustic. And some people relish that. Some people do not.
As long as you can go back to the tour bus and enjoy some air conditioning.
That's right. And that's always the option. That is always, or if they get tired, or if they can't walk anymore,
the bus
is right there waiting for you. Just knock on the door and go sit in there. So people can kind of call the trip the way they want, you know. And we've had people. In fact, one year we had a woman who always, by the time we were going somewhere for dinner, would say, A, I'd never eat supper, and B, I'm exhausted. And she would call a cab and go back to the hotel by herself, and she was perfectly happy with that. As long as we know what people are doing, we really don't, we don't require them to be with us, unless, like I say, we're leaving the country, you know, leaving the area, and we all have to be on a plane.
Okay,
they don't have any options then.
We'll be taking a break soon, but any other things you want to say about your trip to China?
Well, I would say that, you know, going to a place like that where feng shui, you know, started, and walking the land and seeing it in its traditional form, you know, for students and people who've been doing feng shui, there is something about that that really integrates in yourselves, something that you won't get from a picture, something, you know, where the land, you breathe the air, you look at what they did, where their, you get a sense of where their mind was going. Boy, that integrates in a way that you don't get anywhere else. And I think that's the beauty of a trip like that, is just to go to its roots and get back to the origin of it all.
Well, thank you so much for coordinating that. And we will be on a break. We are speaking with Carol Heider. And Carol Heider is the founder and president of the Feng Shui Institute of the Midwest, as well as president of the Wind and Water School of Feng Shui. I am Emmy Louie, and we will be back. Welcome back. I am Emmy Louie, and I have an announcement. Feng Shui Fusion is a unique product company that provides water fountains, salt lamps, jewelry, and many feng shui tools and cures. They also offer high-end decor and Zen lifestyle products, and started out with a simple concept to provide feng shui consultants an easy-to-use resource for all their clients' needs. It is a one-stop shop that has branched out in order to provide more than just feng shui cures for all schools of feng shui, but also offer the beautiful items that the product line has become. Visit www.fengshuifusion.com. Again, that is feng shui fusion, as in fusion cooking, .com. And welcome back. We are here with Carol Heider. I am Emmy Louie, and now we're going to talk about Carol Heider as far as her Master's of Art in East Asian Studies. Tell me, why did you pursue that, Carol Heider?
It's a question that continually ran through my mind as I was doing it. I went back to our University of Minnesota here, and who has a pretty nicely developed East Asian department. And I got a master's in East Asian Studies, and I just completed it in December. And my main reason for doing it, well, I had several. One reason was personal, just personal expansion, just kind of stretching myself. The other reason was that I could have gone and done any master's program, obviously, if I just wanted to stretch. But I took the East Asian Studies to support my feng shui work because I was really looking for a broader context in which to put feng shui, more of a cultural experience, you know, like, what were their minds thinking? What was their poetry like? You know, I obviously didn't go there to learn more feng shui because they don't even teach that. And a lot of the professors weren't really totally sold on the idea of feng shui. They certainly knew about it, but it's been, in the academic world, it still sort of falls into the superstitious area. And so they were all real surprised that I was even doing anything with it. But I went there and I learned the language. I had to study Chinese. And so when I go on these trips, I'm only modestly conversant, but it's very fun for me to go and practice my Chinese. And I studied everything from mythology to Chinese painting to poetry to women's issues in China, and just a huge spectrum, and I truly enjoyed it. I was very sorry to see it come to an end, although at the rate I did it, it took me about 3.5 years. So it was time to be done, but I feel very, I got what I wanted out of that, and although it was an expensive venture, well worth it for me. I truly loved it.
Congratulations on getting your master's. I am a Chinese American. Can you tell me something that you think I might not know?
I doubt that.
Tell me something that you find interesting. I'll tell you if I know it or not.
You mean about the culture?
Whatever.
Okay,
yeah.
Let's see. Oh,
something
God.
That you think is interesting. that you thought, wow, I didn't know that.
Well, I'll tell you one area that I delved into a lot in two of my classes, and that was the tradition of binding feet. And what I discovered is that, you know, and we look at it in horror, like, oh, what a horrible thing to do. And a lot of the research and the data that I read said that a lot of women didn't, I mean, it was so much a part of their culture that they didn't stop to think about, you know, breaking your feet and binding them up and the pain and all that as being anything other than what it was. But along the way, women developed a kinship doing that, because just about daily you had to unwind those feet, clean them because a lot of infection would occur, rewrap them, rebind them. And so they would do that as a group. And what they also did is they developed their own language. And so women had a language that they would speak to one another and they would teach their daughters. And they wrote that language in a lot of their embroidery work, which is still around to this day. There probably aren't, there isn't anyone left anymore who knows that language. But it was, men did not understand it. Women who were not part of the group did not understand it. But it was their own sort of secret code.
Okay, I'm getting chills down my spine. But
I think
okay.
It's fascinating. Did you know that?
I'm sorry?
Did you know that?
Yeah, my grandmother, I forgot. I think she was either involved or she was one of the last generations. But that's fine. I know about it. Well, how about another topic that you thought was very...
Let's see. What else can I talk about here? I thought this was interesting. I'm sure you'll know, but this is very new to me and very, really a fascinating piece because it also moved into the opera, Chinese opera. But men were, you know, trained, and they did they had these big examinations that they did every 3 years. And so for a lot of men, they would go off to study, and that was their whole focus. It was the only way a man could get ahead. But concubines were also schooled, and were, because they were not so much prostitutes, although it could become that, but they were sort of the intellectual half of the male scholars. And so the little girls were taken from their homes, or sometimes little girls were dropped off, were schooled, were trained in singing, were trained in poetry, were taught to read and to write, which was unheard of. A lot of the women couldn't afford to do it, or if they could afford to do it, felt it would put them in have a disadvantage. They didn't want to be too smart if they were going to get a husband. But concubines, they had nothing to lose. I mean, this is their lifeline. So they learned and they studied, and a lot of the poetry that I studied, which was so beautifully written, and I read translations. I wasn't able to read it in its original, but would read translations of it, were written by concubines, were written by women. And so the men found that aspect of the concubine world, well, not only were they also beautiful and they could dance and they could sing, but they were intelligent. And so they would have these poetry contests between the men who were brilliant and these concubines who were also coming into their own. And one particular poem I read, and of course I can't pull up the name right now, written by a concubine, where she bemoans the fact that she cannot take those examinations because she's a woman.
Is this, what era is this? Is this in the early 1920s or something?
Oh, no. It goes way back, much earlier than that. Probably, I would say, probably Ming Dynasty. I mean, we're going back several hundred years.
Okay, so you studied the height, the Ming and the
right.
Tang Dynasty, what you're
right.
talking about.
Tang Dynasty, Ming Dynasty.
Uh-huh.
Yep. So, I just thought that was so interesting,
yeah.
Because speaking as an American, look upon concubines as being prostitutes. You know, they just showed up in their outfits and then they were prostitutes. And I'm sure you're well aware of this, Sammy, is that they were not that. In fact, that was a minor piece to what they did. Instead, they offered men a chance to banter, to they challenged them, they debated with them, they sang for them. I mean, they were very well trained and educated. So.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. I thought that was so cool.
Did you choose?
Because we look upon Chinese women as being so persecuted, and I know that in the rural areas and in the poor areas, that was alive and well. And
did you choose the dynasty that you would study, or what
no.
was that?
No. Did I choose it? No.
They. No, well, that was just the focus.
That was, yes.
Because that was the height.
Yeah, that was the
like
height.
That.
And but we also went through a lot of the times that there wasn't much going on and kind of showing
like
the...
Now.
Like, well, like now, to a certain extent. I think what's going on now is different. I think it's certainly more revolutionary. So.
Yeah. So tell me, anything else you want to say about your master's?
No. I think we covered it. It was great. Let me reminisce for a bit.
Yeah, I know. This is your graduation, your post-graduation
That's right.
Talk. So tell me about your school, your wind and water school.
Well, I started this about 9 years ago, and I started this, it was sort of thrust upon me. I had been doing some classes and some teaching, and, you know, 10, 11 years ago, there weren't a lot of options for people who wanted to study feng shui, and quite honestly, I had to get it where I could. You know, I traveled around. I went all over trying to find people to teach it to me, and so I had some people locally who said, why don't you put together a program? And I said, oh, my God, I'll never do that. That is just something I would never take on. It's way, well, then I did, of course. To cut to the quick, I did. And I started it in 1998. And I had two classes of students, about 12 or 13 in each class. And I really sort of sharpened my claws, if you will, on them, trying to figure out what I was going to teach, how I was going to teach it. And my whole barometer was, how would I want to have learned this if I were in an ideal world? What were things I would have wanted to have learned? So now it's an 18-month program. It takes like two school terms to get through it. I take them with me on appointments, which is what I just ached for when I was learning. I never got that. But I take students with me. Every time we get together, I take them with me on an appointment. We set that up. I train them in mainly black sects, but I also speak about compass. I teach them a little bit of compass that can be integrated with black sects. I know both areas, both perspectives well and use them well. From my vantage point, I think training somebody in black sect is an easier route into feng shui than to start off in compass. I certainly think compass is precious, it's valuable, and I encourage students to then find a compass teacher. That's a hard perspective to teach, and I don't have time to really develop it, so I teach only black sect and then...
It's interesting because I wanted to go back to, I think what you're calling is shadowing, where the student follows you.
Right.
Is a student permitted to say anything during
no.
the consultation?
No, they are not. They are not. They are flies on the wall.
You know, I had a similar situation where I had somebody shadow me.
Yeah.
And I told them, don't say anything.
Yeah.
And it was funny because we got there and the person I said, don't say anything. She goes, oh, I'm from London, too, or I'm from Britain. What about
yeah.
you? And then they started,
yeah.
like, what would you do? I was thinking, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I just said that.
Yeah, yeah. It's very hard.
It's very hard, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because first of all, I thought it was not anything even pertaining to the consultation.
So it was
about them. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was... So strange. Can you tell me about that? Tell me how suggest to people how to set up a good shadowing situation.
Well, the thing about it is that small talk can open the door.
Yeah.
And so somebody will, you know, and it's happened in my groups too. But I just glare them down, and I always have a facilitator. which is somebody who is help. Sometimes I have two, but somebody who is with me on that appointment, who will, you know, pull the person aside, or who will walk over there and say, "You are not to speak." And we have a long lecture about appointment protocol before we even leave to go to that appointment. They are not to speak. They can smile, but they are not to even say, "Oh, I love your house." Nothing. Well, they can
exactly.
say.
Exactly. And you know what? I think some people cannot not speak.
I know.
They just have. I did something similar to this a few years ago. It is similar. We did a talking circle, I think that's what it's called, where anybody who holds a stick can talk. Mm-hmm. It's a Native American thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what that?
Yes,
is,
I do.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, basically, for our listeners, a talking circle, whatever you call it, is basically if you have five or six people in a circle, there's a stick that a person holds, and only the person with holding the stick can talk.
Right.
And that's the protocol. But I found out in the situation, the person that was organizing couldn't stop talking. And
yeah.
I was like, oh, my God, what's
yeah.
going on? Just
yeah.
shut up. You know? I mean, we already decided this from the beginning. Some people can't control themselves. Of course, you know, there's situations in our own lives where maybe I can't control myself in and out or whatever. But it was kind of, this was the protocol. This is what we're going to do, and you're just talking, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, see, I do not even give them an opportunity to even sneeze. And it is hard for people. It is very hard. But I stress it and I stress it and I stress it again. And what I want them to do is if they've got something to say, they're supposed to take their notebooks or something and write that down. Because when we get back from that appointment, then they can say all the stuff they want to say. And then, because, you know, sometimes people I've had in the past, people stop me in the middle of what I'm talking, and I'm talking to a client and go, "Hey, you didn't talk about that bed over there. You didn't." And it's like, you know what? I wasn't going to go there. You know, you know what?
In other words, when you say something, when the shadower says something, they change the consultation.
They completely change it.
They change
then
it.
And the client's looking at me like, "Huh, I wonder why she wasn't going to say that." Or, "Gee, I wonder what's going on that they have to, you know, correct her." I mean, because there's lots of time, most of the time, if that happens, I have purposefully chosen not to go there because we're focusing on something else, because it's only going to derail where their whole thrust should be. And I'm, you know, they're pointing out some little detail, and it's like, you know what? That is not important right now.
Well, you know what's interesting is when I did a talk back in 2000, and I said, you know, some of these people in my class might know more than I do, and this had to do with about churches. I was teaching a class on churches. They might know more than I do. And then the administrator for the school said, "You are teaching the class. It doesn't matter
if
people know more than you. You're in control of the class. Because of that, you are teaching the class. Period."
Right. Right. And there's also another person who's so important to this, and that's the client. Because they don't need us all to pile in, debate among ourselves, give them 10 different things to do, and then leave. And they've gotten it from five different people. They need one source of information, one consistent source, so they can write that down. And then if after the end of my discussion with the group, they've come up with some fabulous ideas, I, of course, call the client and say, "We had this conversation. Hey, some other great things came up, and I think they're worth sharing." But
mm-hmm.
And it comes from me and not from...
So there's a unity. There's a unity. That's
exactly
very important. Unity of customer service.
Right. That's right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Any other points about that before we take a break?
No, but I really agree with you. And I have been in a situation once when I was studying with Roger Green, and he took us, and he said, "Yeah, I prefer you guys don't talk." I had to, like, put my fist in my mouth because I so wanted to say a few things. So I know exactly where they're at, but that could ruin the whole experience for the group and for the client. And the bottom line is we're there for the client, and they need
absolutely,
to have a good experience.
Absolutely. We're here with Carl Heider. I am Emmy Louie, and we will be back.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I am Emmy Louie, and we are here with Carol Heider, who is the founder and president of Windwater School of Feng Shui, as well as the founder and president of the Feng Shui Institute of the Midwest. So tell me about your personal feng shui program, Carol Heider.
Yeah, that came about just in the last couple years because I had people contact me who said, do you have anything that you're teaching that isn't, that's between 2 hours in length and 2 years in length? Because they wanted to learn more about it, but they didn't want to take the training program, and they'd taken a lot of intro classes, and they just needed more. And so I came up with this six-part series that's being offered by a local community college here in Minnesota. And what it does is it gets people in touch with their own space, and so they have to bring their blueprint of their home. And for 6 weeks, six consecutive weeks, one night a week, we address one aspect. I teach the first night, which is sort of a general, you know, lay of the land, big picture kind of class. And then I have four of my graduate students who teach other aspects. One teaches about partnership and money. Another teaches about gardens. Another teaches about clutter. Another one teaches about space clearing. And then the last week, we all of the instructors and I come back and we do a wrap up. And meanwhile, in between each of these classes, these people have homework to do. And so they go home and they look at a specific area, or they figure out how to lay out the bagua, or they start dealing with clutter, or they do a little ceremony in their space. And so that last night is sort of a kind of a wind-up, you know, and people have stories, and they have pictures, and they talk about things. And because in 6 weeks, if you're working real focused on your own space, something's going to start shifting. Something's going to happen. We typically sell out the class. We have between 25 and 30 people for every time we do this class. So it's been very successful, clearly something that people are looking for that doesn't take up, you know, 2 years of their life, and they don't have to put that kind of commitment into it, and yet gives them more information than they get from a short one-evening class. And it also is, you know, the other option is for them to hire somebody to come out and, you know, just do a feng shui appointment for them. But what's really good about this is people have to really think about their own space. Sometimes I think when people hire a consultant, they want you to do it for them. It's like they want you to tell them what to do. In this little personal program, people have got to really think that through for themselves. And I think it's fabulous. I think it's very, very strong program and clearly something that's needed here.
And so that is very different from the Feng Shui Institute of the Midwest?
Yes. Now, the Institute is, we have a very, clearly a very active community here in the Twin Cities. The Institute is an offshoot of that very first class that I taught back in 1998. They stayed with me several years, and I kept coming up with material, and we kept, you know, going through more information, and, you know, it's giving me a chance to sort of hone how I wanted to teach this program. But as we were coming up to one of the end of those years, they said, you know, we need sort of a group. We need a community. And so we put together this little nonprofit called the Institute of the Midwest. And what we do is meet on a quarterly basis. We provide not only the feng shui community, but the public an opportunity to hear somebody speak on some feng shui-related topic without it being feng shui. So as an example, we have had a Chinese calligrapher come in and give a an hour-and-a-half presentation. We've had somebody who cooks with the five elements come in and do a presentation. We've had a Chinese man who makes his own wind instruments come in. We've had somebody come in and speak about space clearing. We've had somebody come in and speak about meditation. So it's sort of related to feng shui, but not. It's a little more cultural. We had a Taoist scholar in town come in and speak on the Tao Te Ching in January. And so these people, if they're members of the Institute, can come and hear all this for free. And they get a free listing on our website. And if the Institute has any participation in any trade shows, then as a member you can go and work the trade show for free. So plus it's networking. They have to qualify to be part of the group. So if people call and say, what are your qualifications? If they say, well, I'm a member of the Feng Shui Institute of the Midwest. Now a lot of the public may go, I don't even know what that is. Those of us who are in the community would know, well, if you're part of that institute, you've had to qualify to be part of it, and so that says you've had training. And so we do outreach work, we do volunteer work, we're setting out to do a garden here that's all volunteer. And so, you know, we beautify places, we do speakers, we network with one another, we support each other. And that's really what its focus is. And it's,
well, you must be doing something right because you have an institute or you have people.
And we have people. And
that's,
any one of those,
magnificent.
It is magnificent, Emmy. Any one of those meetings, we have between 30 and 60 people show up for them. And most of them are feng shui people. There's also some public. You can bring friends. I mean, they're
what
fabulous.
What is the secret to that? Is it your management skills? What's going on?
My management skills? I wish I could say that was what it was. I think it just speaks to the caliber of people who study feng shui. It speaks to certainly the energy of the people here in the Midwest who are vibrant and active and interested. And, you know, I think one of the things that I will take some credit for is as I've been training more and more people, the thing that I don't want to create is competition. I don't want people to be I want a network. I want people to see the new group coming up and not look at them as, oh, God, there's just more people in the field. I want, this is more help. These are more people that you can get to know and support one another. And, you know, as new people come up, the older people, you know, kind of rise up a little bit more. And more new people come up, and then those new people become, you know, old hands. And so it's just all about that hierarchical structure that really works. You know, one hand reaching down to help the other. And that's what I love about this institute is it really wasn't my idea. In fact, I kind of said, oh, my gosh, I don't need to do another thing. And it really, it took on a life of its own. And so
obviously, because you have even said earlier that you said something about, even early on, you said, oh, that was thrust upon me.
Yeah.
I would never do that.
I didn't want to do a training program. Well, you know, as many of us who've been in the feng shui world for so many years, a lot of times we're propelled down the road maybe faster than we wanted, and that, you know, I not meant to be a complaint by any means, but there were times when I wished, gosh, it'd be nice if I could think this through a little bit more, but oh no, you know, off we go, and it all works out, you know, it all has worked out really beautifully.
Which is rather interesting, because I think you mentioned that you wanted to talk about the future of the industry, was that correct?
Yes.
You wanted to it was interesting that you're mentioning all of these things too, but I think that's on your mind, so you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, you know, I think...
Well, was there another question, too?
I think segueing to that here at the end is really appropriate because, you know, it's sort of a question that I have a lot of students ask me. You know, they say, well, I'm going to sign up for your two-year program, but what's the future? You know, what's going to happen here? Is there going to be anything left to do? And the truth is, I do believe that novelty, that's not a really good word, but that is the word I want. The novelty of feng shui has tempered, and I believe everybody's heard of it now. I think that, so that's, we're through that phase. But I think that as it's becoming more and more mainstream, more and more accepted, more and more people are going to need to know about it. And so I don't think that there's not going to be enough jobs, enough work for everybody. I think there's going to be not enough practitioners for all the work that's going to happen. Because
that's why I'm in this too myself, because I agree with you, and there's a dimensional shift going on.
Yeah. Yes, there is. There's an awareness.
And when that comes in, there won't be enough
right.
of people.
Right.
I feel because we're only needing that more and more.
Well, we are. And, you know, now as corporations and hospitals and hotels and restaurants are going, well, let's get some feng shui in here. You know, where are all these people going to come from? You know, there's only so many hours in the day and there's only so much, you know, and in addition to that, more and more people are traveling to China and traveling to Hong Kong, where it is so much a part of their lives there. And so they come back and go, wow, you know, I was trying to open a business in Hong Kong or open a subsidiary office in Hong Kong, and I had to have a feng shui person. You know, I didn't even know what was going on, but I had to have a feng shui person.
Yeah.
Or they're getting investment money from Asia, and they're saying, we're not investing unless you have some kind of feng shui person look over your property. So, you know, in some ways they're having to do it, but they're also waking up to it and seeing the value of it.
Yeah, there's an interesting show that I did with Stephen Skinner, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Skinner, and he lives in Malaysia. He published the Feng Shui for Modern Living.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it was a really great interview, and it's archived on www.bbsradio.com, which is the station that you're listening to right now. But any other thoughts about that? I think we only have like a minute or two.
Well, I think that I feel it's a real exciting time. I think that not only is Feng Shui opening up, but lots of other things, and it's following along the same path as yoga, which at first was, oh, my gosh, it's a religion, don't study that. Following along the path of acupuncture, oh, my God, that's weird, don't do that. You know, all of that's becoming accepted, and people are using it. Insurance companies are paying for it, and I think it's inevitable feng shui will reach that same level of acceptability.
Yeah, it's reached like a plateau, but then there's still another level that it definitely can go up to.
Yeah, yes. Yes, it's
and I, what I think it is actually is when governments embrace it.
Wouldn't that be?
That would happen. I think that's what it is because that's mm-hmm. usually tips it over. Or I think mm-hmm. in yoga it was had to do with insurance.
Mm-hmm.
When it's institutionalized, and that's the case in Malaysia or Hong Kong, when it's a part of the institution, it becomes part of that culture.
Yeah. Boy, that would really tip the scales, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and it's you can see it slowly, it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway,
mm-hmm.
so yep, it's kind of interesting to be a part of that.
It is.
In whatever way we can be a part of that, although it's, I think that's why we're listening to this show or people are tuning in, is so often that we do our daily thing and we don't see the big picture.
Right.
It's often difficult. Even when you do see the big picture, you're still having a certain viewpoint of it.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
So,
well, and in a field that's sort of new like this.
Yeah, we need to end. Thank
and,
you
and
so much, Carol.
And it took off so quickly in the beginning.
Yeah.
It was just like, wow, we can't, you know, everybody's got to study it. And now it's sort of, and so people are perceiving that as, oh, well, it was a flash in the pan.
Yes.
And
what is your website?
www.carolheider.com, and that's Carol with an E on the end.
Yeah, carolheider.com. You can also look at my website at www.emyloue.com. Sorry, we're out of time, Carol Heider. It was interesting listening to you.
Thank
and
you,
all the
Emmy.
Things that you're doing. Congratulations on all of this stuff.
Thank
it's
you.
It's amazing work that you are doing. Thank you, Carol Heider, and I am Emmy Louie. You're listening to The Emmy Louie Show. Namaste.